This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 97-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Chuck Keene of Porterville, California. The population there now is right around 60,000, and no doubt many families remember Chuck as their electrician. That's a profession his Navy service in World War II prepared him for. We're going to hear about his time at sea on the cruiser USS Honolulu and the destroyer escort USS John C. Butler. But since he's one of the last people alive to experience Imperial Japan's surprise attack on Oahu on December 7, 1941, I'd like to explore a little more about the days and weeks that followed. I'm sure, Chuck, there've got to be things that you saw, you heard, you smelled, you experienced, things that are still very vivid nearly 78 years later.
One of the most vivid things is cutting the guy's mouth open to find how many teeth they had so they could identify them, but they didn't have an ID card or tag. The only way you could check them would be with their dental records. You just had to pry open the guy's mouth to count the teeth. That was horrible to me. I mean, to this day, I've never got over that, but we had to do it. You had to find out who they were, and most of them, they successfully located a lot of them, but some they didn't, which, you know, there's 408, I think, of the ones that first day that they couldn't identify.
You got put on a detail to go bury some of them?
Yes, I was on a detail to bury them, and I was also on the detail when we were identifying the ones that were seriously hurt. Some of the hangars on the island were, we collected them, but they buried up above Honolulu, up there on the thing. I really have trouble with that because I was up there, but I couldn't tell anybody how you get up there to it, you know, but it was a hill.
It's the Punch Bowl crater, which is now an American cemetery. A lot of people go to the Arizona Memorial and everything that's around Pearl Harbor, but the Punch Bowl is one of the most moving places I've ever been.
That's where we put them in, and we never had identification for all of them, and on the ones that we didn't, they put their dental records, and keep in mind that it's 72 degrees, it's hot, and you know what happens to bodies when it gets warm, they go to swelling, and we had to get them buried. And so that shocked me that we couldn't do any more than what we did. We just took a string and tied it around their neck and put their ID up on the post. So, and that's the way but they were the lucky ones. They were the ones that could be identified. And some of them didn't, you know, we didn't know. And then others would put their dental record up there.
And the ones that weren't identified in recent years, there's been an exhumation, and they have gone back, and they've been able to identify quite a few of those sailors.
I sort of blocked that out of my mind. I knew they were doing it. They were covering guys up. That's what the way that it was told to me. A chief told me, he says, they're covering them up. And I knew that he meant they were just burying them.
Well, and you underscored the urgency of doing that for just physical reasons. But did it weigh on you at the time that those people, those victims of this attack were not identified and that their families would not have that final answer?
That didn't bother me. The thing that bothered me more than anything else is they gave me morphine. And for all of them that were crying or hollering, you know, for something, he just said, just give them a shot of morphine. Well, we were going along there, we were shoving morphine into those guys, and I thought I'd killed about 400, and I never knew until the nurse come here that I couldn't, you know, I had that on my mind for 60 years that I helped kill them, but they say I didn't, so I got some relief from that. But she said that if you put morphine into a muscle, it's not going to kill anybody, you know, with the dose that we give. But if it went into a vein or an artery, it could, but where you just put it in the arm, it didn't. It said you give them relief. And I know from being an explosion myself that morphine will certainly do away with pain right away. I myself screamed for it in an explosion aboard John C. Butler. I mean, one of the main connections exploded while I was trying to show the yard superintendent what was happening, and it just boom, it arced, and no fuse, no nothing. It's tied into the main energy on the dock. We just melted a hole. We had a half-inch steel. Just melted down, and it knocked me out. I don't know what happened that I got out, but When I came to, I was in a van and they had a pull motor on me. I think that's probably as close to dead as I've ever been, because I can always remember just like circles of gray and just going back and forth, and all of a sudden I realized I'm moving, and they had me in an ambulance taking me to the Naval Hospital in Long Beach.
Well, and I want to come back to that with you, but sticking with the Pearl Harbor situation, so here you are, 19 years old, and you're having to care for the wounded and then to bury some of the dead, whether they can be identified or not. With that, now that more than 75 years later, they have been able, because of technology, to go back and identify some of them and give the families that closure. Does that mean anything to you, to be aware of that?
Oh, yes, that means everything to me, because the idea of knowing that someone is out, I have one that still bothers me, because I know that they've never identified him. He was a pilot on an SOC, which the Honolulu had four planes, search observation craft, on the back, and he lost track of us, and he was running out of gas, and he was the only one that I really knew on there. And he crashed that thing into the near Kodiak. He crashed it, and strange enough, almost 2 years later, they had the pontoon from that was aboard the Helena, I think, had the pontoon. It had numbers and said, this was from your plane. Well, nobody knew what happened to him. All we knew is what happened to the plane. But I've always, you say, can you ever remember it? Yeah, I remember. I remember the last time I ever shook his hand.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, Morrison. He was an ensign. We didn't get really close to those guys normally, but they were a breed of themselves. I mean, they didn't have the spit and polish side of the Navy, and they were more free and easy, and they could talk with the men, you know. Some of the officers were too straight-laced. You couldn't do anything with them.
So that was a little later on, but what did you guys do after you sailed from Pearl Harbor to San Francisco?
Well, we came back and had 9 days leave. I went to Idaho. I was up there 2 days, and they said, get back to the ship. So I just had to turn around and come back. I had to borrow $80 from my dad for a flight to get back to the ship, and I just barely made it. You know, there's no excuse for missing ship.
Well, you mentioned going back home to Idaho, and that makes me wonder, had your parents been concerned that you may have been killed when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
It was real slow on notifying on ships that were damaged or anything. And then it finally got to where they wouldn't list it at all, because the minute you listed a ship as damaged, they'd get the paper, and the Japanese knew exactly where they were. They plotted all of them. So that's why they didn't tell. But my parents, my mother thought I was just going AWOL anyway. There wasn't anybody missing me.
So you just barely make it back to your ship, and then what?
Well, I got back to the ship, we went aboard, and the first thing we were doing was going down to San Diego to get some radar stuff. We didn't even know what a radar was, really, at that time. They were just out putting them up. We went down there and got that, and then we were back out to sea, and we joined the first convoy. We were the weapon and the ears for the convoy that was going back, because we had real fine sonar gear. You know, we could pick submarines up quicker than a destroyer could. We had real good gear on there. Gathered a whole slew of ships and headed for Melbourne. And the minute we got back from there, they put us on forced draft speed, and we were going to Alaska up there for the Battle of Midway. We thought we were going to Battle of Midway. We ended up being up on the north end of it, protecting Kodiak, Alaska. They didn't want the Japanese to come into Kodiak, because that was our main fuel station for all of our planes and ships in that area was Kodiak.
That's when you lost your friend Morrison, was up there in the Aleutians?
Yeah, they fly out. SOCs, search observation craft, were a new thing, and because they could fly up and they, like you can see a whale or whatever it was, they got up there, they could spot submarines. They could look down in the water and see them, and we know right where to go to get them. And we knocked off they got a whole bunch of submarines that way by flying up high. Well, he was out on one of those missions, and he stayed out too long or whatever it was, and the weather was really, you know, it would be like all bright sun like this, and then all of a sudden everything is fogged up to where you couldn't see. It could happen in a half a day or in an hour.
You know, I thought of something else I didn't ask you with regard to Pearl Harbor. I've heard a lot over the years from guys about how that made them feel. That, I mean, of course, the famous quote from Yamamoto was, I fear we've awakened a sleeping giant. and I've seen the posters with the tattered flag and remember Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand what the sentiment was among your fellow sailors after Japan carried out that surprise attack?
Yeah, just kill. Just kill them any way that you could kill them. We had no thought of going home or anything else. There wasn't anybody in the Navy that thought of anything other than going to get in the Japanese. It didn't make any difference how you did it. And Halsey come along with a sign that used to have big billboards that said Lucky Strike cigarettes, Chester Hill cigarettes, and things like that. He took those and he put them out there on those islands and said, kill Japs, kill more Japs. And he had them all over the Pacific. That was more or less the logic. That's what we were out there for, and nobody tried to dress it up pretty or anything like that. We're just going to kill some Japs. They killed a lot of us. I never did feel like we got even. I still don't to this day, but it had to end somewhere. And the logic says that it was good that they ended it the way they did. But because a lot of you guys wouldn't be here either. If we'd had to go to war in Japan itself, it's just miserable.
So what about the day where your ship got torpedoed? Where were you guys, and how did that unfold?
We were protecting a landing area for the Marines to go into New Georgia Island. And the Japanese were on one side, and we were on the other. And we wanted to make sure that we did away with as many of them as we could. And we sank some, and I can tell you that we just sailed the ship right through clusters of guys hanging on to rafts or whatever they could hang on. I was aboard. You look at that picture, there's two searchlights up there. We finally found out this most stupid thing we had during the World War was to have those searchlights. You know, that was carried over from World War One. You turn a searchlight on the Japanese Navy, and they'd fire right down, and they could range on it, and they'd hit. You give them a direct hit.
Here we are. We're over here. Fire away.
That's exactly what happened. So they finally took those away from us. But that's where I was when those things come in, was up there on the searchlight.
So how did you experience it? Did you feel what happened? Did you see something?
Not really. I mean, to me, I was kept wondering why we weren't shooting back. But the Japanese shot at us. In fact, as they hit one of the stacks, those searchlights are up there, and one of the rounds of something off of the Japanese tore one of our stacks. So I was pretty close to action there, but I don't know.
Well, and I think it's pretty close to be pushing an armed torpedo back out of your ship, too. I mean, that's pretty close. What does that feel like, by the way, when you don't know if that thing is...
You have to do what you have to do. That's basically what it was. I had a Marine buddy that lived out here pretty close to here. And I asked him that same question. When you're in one of those landing craft and you got 12 guys around you, how do you ever make yourself going? He says, well, you just all go together. And that's the way he explained it. And I think that's pretty much the way we were down there. We had a torpedo in there. We had to get rid of it. And you don't think, oh, my God, it's going to kill me or anything. We never had any thought other than getting rid of the torpedo.
And if they hadn't, we would not be having this conversation. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the hole that torpedo was pushed back out through, not to mention other photos of the USS Honolulu. More of 97-year-old Chuck Keene's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.